Welcome to a new episode of the Structural Heart Podcast. Today's host, Dr. Dan O'Hare, interviews Dr. Hemal Gada.
Hello, thanks for joining. Today we're going to do a deep dive into the low-risk TAVR trials for SAPIEN and Evolut. And I'm going to be joined by our special guest, Dr. Hemal Gada, renowned interventional cardiologist, structuralist, and president of the Heart and Vascular Institute at UPMC Pinnacle in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Today we're going to cover all kinds of topics like death and stroke, thrombosis, whose valves are failing and why, and all kinds of super important TAVR topics. But I want to start here with the 12 days of P3. Hemal, welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I really enjoyed your series as a surgeon, found it fascinating. Tell us a little bit about what compelled you to write that.
You know, Dan, I have always been an advocate of the best patient care possible, and we do that through data in this field. That's one of the reaffirming things about being a structural heart doctor is that you can count on randomized controlled trial data, the highest level of data informing our decision making on a daily basis. And so really the whole kind of target of the 12 days of PARTNER 3-5 year was to present data that maybe wasn't made to light during the initial presentation and publication of the PARTNER 3-5 year presentation manuscript. And then also to inspire some people to really think critically about data in a way that maybe they hadn't before. And so that was really my motivation for putting that all together. And I know that we're going to dissect parts of it, but in general, it was just to shed light on data and an interpretation of data that I don't think was allowed during the initial presentation and publication of that.
Yeah, that's great. I'm curious. I know it got a lot of attention, hundreds of thousands of views. What kind of feedback did you get from folks?
You know, a lot of people, you know, just kind of pinged me and said, I didn't realize that the supplemental appendix contained this, or that the presentation led us this way, and really the truth is another way. Those were all very cool kind of communications that I had with physician colleagues, partners in industry, and a whole swath of healthcare administrators even. So it was just very interesting to read those. Obviously, you get some emotional kind of responses here and there for people that may feel differently. But I really got no reasonable arguments against any of the substance of what was presented. And so I really found that to be interesting. And of course, it just keeps me going because obviously we need this type of reasoning and logic and evidence-based approach to fuel what we do on a daily basis.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I you know, these two trials, randomizing valves, transcatheter valves against the gold standard of surgery, they were very similar and yet very different. I think there's so much we can learn from them. I wanted to ask your thoughts on a couple different topics related to the two randomized trials. First, exclusion rates. Can you comment on how exclusionary each of these trials were?
Sure. Let me do that by introducing some potential bias here. We were the worldwide lead enroller in the Medtronic low-risk trial at our institution at UPMC Pinnacle. We randomized about 128 patients between SAVR and TAVR in the Medtronic low-risk trial, by far the lead enroller. And so we were very much, I would say, wedded to the outcomes of this study. Something that was very important for us to conduct appropriately, make it as all comers and real world as possible, and then use those outcomes to, again, fuel our decision-making moving forward. And so, you know, jumping on those calls and presenting those patients that we eventually got included into the study was basically a cakewalk, because anatomically there were no real big exclusions. And then clinically, we kind of knew who a low-risk patient was. And those patients, the screening calls were very short. Patients got in. And if you look at kind of the disapproval rate out of the Medtronic low-risk trial, it was under 15%. It was about 14%. And a lot of those disapprovals were bicuspid patients that went into the Medtronic low-risk bicuspid study that was going on at the same time. And so really the screen fail rate, if you will, was very low for that study. What we noticed for PARTNER 3 is that something very different happened. Out of the patients that were kind of presented to the screening committee for approval, we saw about 34% of those patients get excluded, primarily because of anatomic reasons. And the biggest anatomic reason was left ventricular outflow tract calcium, which represented about 38% of the anatomic screen fails. So that in and of itself is very interesting. And then, you know, kind of fuels questions about whether this trial is applicable to our current low-risk population.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could always exclude calcium from the treatment of our patients? But you just can't. And calcium's been the enemy of surgeons forever. The other thing, I think it was probably, actually it's probably fortuitous that they excluded those patients, since we know that the annular rupture rate in a calcified annulus with the balloon expandable device is somewhere around 11-fold higher than a self-expanding device. And this is, you know, this would have obviously introduced a lot more mortality into the trial, which of course nobody needs. What about the endpoints? I wanted to ask you about that. You know, there's when we look at the partner three, this death, stroke, and rehospitalization composite versus death and stroke in Evolute. Do you have any thoughts on how that may have colored the outcomes or what those, how those functioned as outcomes?
Well, I mean, you know, that's just the nature of the therapies that were involved here, right? And so introducing rehospitalization is, in a way, kind of stacking the deck in favor of the less invasive approach that's going to allow for ambulation within hours of the procedure. And that is percutaneous transfemoral transcatheter aortic valve replacement, which even in the mid-20-teens was something that was a very low morbidity out of the gates, especially in a low-risk patient population. And so you could argue that the outcomes, at least acutely, and maybe even out to like 1 year, are more reflective of the actual idiosyncrasies of the therapies that were employed. Having a sternotomy-based or right chest-based aortic valve replacement, being in the hospital for 5 to 7 days afterwards, and then having a rehab course, a recovery course that could be quite extensive after that, is going to really be in stark contrast to a patient that has a percutaneous transfemoral TAVR, ambulates within hours of the procedure, maybe goes home the next day and resumes their quality of life. But then what we see happen after 1 year could probably be more attributed to the actual valves and the actual design of the valves that were implanted. And so we really need to look critically at those outcomes, especially extending after 1 year of follow-up.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. My personal impression was it felt like a little bit like putting the thumb on the scale, leaning toward TAVR when you include rehospitalization for all the reasons we know patients get readmitted after surgery. What about the methodology, you know, the statistical analysis plan? Do you have any comments on that? That was another thing I thought some people were, you know, maybe somewhat confused by. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I was confused by it as well. And I kind of take to myself as kind of understanding a lot of these statistical methods. But yeah, it's true. The statistical analysis plan for Partner 3 was revised or revamped in some way between the 1 and 2 year data snapshots that were presented in 2019 and 2020. And then the more recent publication and presentation of the 5 year data, the statistical analysis plan then included a hierarchical composite endpoint, which included the primary endpoints that we knew from the non-hierarchical composite, but basically rank ordered them in what we call a win ratio. And so that's very confusing. I mean, to have mortality from an aortic stenosis study and heart failure rehospitalization included in the same kind of page, have a non-weighted assessment of those outcomes, and then develop some sort of premise that TAVR won more than surgery did, not statistically significant, but still numerically higher, and still lost numerically on mortality. That really is a very confusing kind of thing to go through and reason through. And of course, that was one of the central figures in the manuscript. So it was out there for everyone to see and everyone to scratch their heads at.
Yeah, I you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? We've all heard that expression. You know, I think it's so important to be clear on these topics, because we rely on this data to guide our patients. And the clarity that Medtronic showed, I think, was, for me, was extremely appreciated. And the transparency of showing the data year after year is really helpful. We'll need that from both groups in the future, disclosure. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about stroke and death. You know, the P3 five-year study, if you look at 5 years, the hazard ratio, you know, was 1.6, I believe. you know, translating to like a 66% increase of having a stroke or being dead at 5 years when compared to surgery. I thought that was remarkable. I mean, I think that's something patients understand. And then when you look at, conversely, at the Evolute trial, at 4 years, there was a 25% less risk of stroke or death. So this seemed to be like somehow didn't make major news. And I think it's huge. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that it's buried in page 35 of the supplemental appendix and wasn't presented in any of the presentations during that day, October 24th at TCT. And so, I you do have to kind of dig to find it, but it is a very important figure. And again, if we developed a shared decision-making tool with that landmark analysis on page 35 of the Partner 3-5-year manuscript supplemental appendix, I'm not sure if any patients would be choosing transcatheter aortic valve replacement, looking at the divergence of those KM curves favoring surgery in those important outcomes of mortality and stroke out to 5 years. And at the very least, it merits annual data moving forward to see what type of trends, if not statistically significant things, kind of come out of an annual look of this data. I think any kind of venture to hide or suppress data when we see these kind of concerning trends should come under intense scrutiny.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it is fascinating to see how the valves appear to be performing very differently, especially when measured by mortality and stroke. Yeah, I wanted to just ask you about a couple other things real quick. Structural valve deterioration and bioprosthetic valve dysfunction as broad topics. The patients often want to know, how long is my valve going to last? Am I going to need something done again in the future? When I look back at the Sapien data, it appears around year three, whether it's partner two or partner three, it seems like around year three, something is happening. And in each of the reports, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that numerically, Sapien had a higher rate of structural valve deterioration than the surgical implants in both of these studies. And so, again, you have to dig to find the data. But I thought, again, that was an interesting contrast versus Evolute, where the structural valve deterioration looks to be significantly less at 5 years, especially in the small valves. But maybe I'd like to hear your thoughts on structural valve deterioration in the two platforms.
Yeah, I would say that it's not just small valves, although small valves are definitely involved in this discrepancy as well. But I would say all valve sizes are involved as it relates to Sapien, as it relates to the balloon expandable valve. And I think that we saw that during the presentation at TCT, when the valve sizes really didn't differ with regards to those composite primary endpoint, or, you know, all-cause mortality in general, like, wasn't different between valve sizes. And so you're right, rates of structural valve deterioration matter. And I do believe that they predict clinical outcomes if they're studied in with the appropriate definitions. And that's kind of where it gets a little bit blurry. Definitions have changed over the years. In fact, if we just look at Partner 3 follow-up, there was a transition from VARC 2 to VARC 3 that happened during the 5 years of this study. What does VARC 3 not catch? Well, you know, rates of oral anticoagulant use. And so in VARC 2, structural valve deterioration or dysfunction, some level of problem with the valve would have been detected, because putting a patient on oral anticoagulation was definitely signified in VARC 2. Whereas in VARC 3, that just goes away. And so if you look at page 51 of the Partner 3 5-year supplemental appendix, you will find a very interesting table looking at oral anticoagulation use over time. And of course, with transcatheter aortic valve replacement, that percentage and the absolute number of patients on OAC go up over time. We don't know why. Maybe all of them had new onset atrial fibrillation. I doubt it. Okay. But they don't really give us enough substance to really understand why there's elevation in use of oral anticoagulation with the balloon expandable valve over time.
Yeah, it's fascinating to watch. And I think the data will become more and more clear. You saw the stuff we published last year around this time, that in patients who were treated with Evolute, the risk of structural valve deterioration was fully half of the surgical implants. And when you look at the small valves, 1/4 of the incidence. So it really looks like these valves are performing very differently, especially as we get out beyond 3 years. Hey, let's talk about a little bit about valves failing, since we're kind of on that direction. You know, in my view as a surgeon, you know, we see these things in the operating room from time to time, and generally, you know, it looks like there's some thrombus formation, some fibrin deposition, fibrosis, and calcification. In my view, somewhat of a spectrum of a pathologic process. And then the valves get stiff, and then there's hemodynamic deterioration. Why do you think this is happening? Or is there a difference between the devices that may make one device more prone to this kind of thrombosis phenomenon?
This is why valve design is so important to understand. There is a very big difference between the supraannular self-expanding Evolut valve and the intraannular balloon expandable Sapien valve. Just design differences that couldn't be even you can't find even a bigger difference between valve platforms surgically than what you have there. And to liken this back to what happens with like the Trifecta surgical aortic valve, you know, there was a very limited investigation that led to FDA approval. It was kind of similar to the low risk trials, honestly. And so back in 2011, there was about 1,014 patients that were followed by the FDA in this IDE study for Trifecta that were followed for an average of 0.9 years. And off of that, they approved this valve for commercial use for surgical aortic valve replacement. And lo and behold, when we see the outcomes going out to 5 and 7 years for the Trifecta, we not only saw enhanced and increased rates of structural valve deterioration versus non-Trifecta surgical aortic valves, but we saw a trend for worse mortality with the Trifecta surgical aortic valve, which led to it getting pulled off the market last summer. We shouldn't really think that TAVR valves are absolved from this type of, again, follow-up and just kind of reassessment. And yes, the problem with the balloon expandable platform as it's designed right now is what happens to the neosinuses. Basically, if the valve is fully expanded, it could lead to stagnation of neosinus flow, which could potentially lead to things like valve thrombosis or whatever other definition or label you want to throw at that, that could limit the integrity of the valve moving forward and potentially force forward deleterious outcomes like mortality and stroke. So just to link it all together, this is a design problem. This is not like reduction of residual mineral aldehydes is going to fix this issue. This is a valve that is stagnating neosinus flow, and there's really nothing that's being thrown at that valve to improve that particular consequence.
Yeah, I think in PARTNER 3, in the 2-year data, the thrombosis rate versus surgery was almost 4 times higher in the transcatheter device, the Sapien device. And that, again, it makes me wonder if this is the beginning of more trouble for the valve. And as you mentioned, the Trifecta story, I know you're a TAVR historian. And so history tends to repeat itself, doesn't it? So we need to learn from that. We need to watch this very closely beyond 5 years. And Trifecta had a huge fall off after 5 years. I think it's really crucial that we learn the longer term outcomes of these valves, because something could happen very quickly. So I think that's, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, and I love getting your historical perspective. You know, and we want to be on the right side of history when we look back on how we've treated patients. And I think the evidence is pointing, starting to point one way rather than another. Hemel, brother, thank you so much. I feel like we could go on for another hour talking about this stuff. I know you're passionate about it, and so am I. But thank you so much for your insights, for being here. And thank you, everyone, for joining today. Hey, join us next time for our special guest, Dr. Michael Gibson, professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School, CEO of the BAIM Harvard Clinical Research Institute, and a practicing interventional cardiologist, as we look to better understand the perspectives of a non-TAVR implanting cardiologist, how he measures success with his patients after TAVR, and what keeps him up at night.